The latest study on infertility released by the World Health Organization says 1 in 6 individuals globally are affected by infertility in their lifetime. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to look at the reasons why infertility in some regions of the world is growing while other regions are on the decline. Let's get started. The human body is extremely complex, and the ability to reproduce involves multiple systems to work together in two individuals, all in order to produce a single human life. For some, it might be easy, while others, a challenge, if not impossible. Infertility is an emotional struggle, which is deeply personal, and it is a global phenomenon which does not affect an individual or region uniformly. If you've ever looked into the eyes of a couple who are trying to have a child but cannot, you see a deep emotional and physical pain, which sometimes is so strong it can even break the couple. However, there is no greater rejoicing than from a couple who has faced the challenge and overcome, either naturally or with the help of science. Both of these examples are what unite us, regardless of our nationality as human. But to help us discuss infertility around the globe is Marcia Inhorn. Now, she is a professor of anthropology and international affairs at Yale University and author of the book Motherhood on Ice. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Do we have a global growing infertility crisis, and why?
Yeah, infertility is a global reproductive health problem. I think I would call it a crisis because approximately 10% of all reproductive aged couples around the world are going to face the problem of infertility at some point in their reproductive lives. And, you know, there are causes of infertility that are growing around the world. For example, something called polycystic ovary syndrome, a hormonal metabolic problem. So yeah, we are facing a significant infertility problem. It's estimated that anywhere between 50 million and 186 million people around the world are infertile right now. The estimates are imprecise, but it's millions of people around the world suffering from the inability to conceive a child. And so it's a problem. I consider it to be a reproductive justice issue as well, because the definition of reproductive justice is the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, and the right to parent a child in a safe and healthy environment. And infertility is about the right to have a child and the difficulties in having a child. So it's really something that we should be addressing as part of the reproductive health agenda around the world.
Marcia, I love the fact that you're bringing up men. So why do you think male sperm counts and total testosterone dropped so precipitously in the past several decades, mainly in the West? Is this a global trend?
Yeah, you know, male infertility is the hidden reproductive health problem. When we think of infertility, women are always the ones assumed to be the infertile party. But more than half of all cases of involuntary childlessness around the world are due to male factors. And so we really need to be acknowledging male infertility much more than we do. Men are just sort of ignored in this issue altogether. And so I really appreciate your bringing it up. A lot of male infertility is really not preventable and not curable because there's a genetic etiology to it. There are genetic factors that cause male infertility. And, you know, men are born with this problem. It's a chronic reproductive health condition for them. And there's not a whole lot that they could do to treat it. There are assisted reproductive technologies, particularly a variant of IVF called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, that is, you know, a solution for many infertile men. But, you know, you're right. Why, you know, there are other things going on that are causing, you know, these cases of male infertility. If more than half of the world's cases of childlessness are due to male factors. And so we need to be looking at things like smoking. More than 50% of the world's men smoke, and smoking is not good for male reproductive health. It's spermatotoxic. And there probably are environmental factors that are coming to play. We know, for example, that certain pesticides cause infertility in agricultural workers. Certainly, all of the chemicals and toxins that have been used in warfare around the world are not good for fertility. And so, Yeah, we're probably seeing an increase in male infertility cases due to environmental factors that really need to be studied further.
Now, you have said male infertility is the hidden story of the Middle East. Why do you believe this is an issue for men, and why is it not being addressed?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the reason I focus on the Middle East is that's where the majority of my scholarship has been located for the past 30 years. I've done a lot of work in Egypt, Lebanon, the United Arab Emirates. I'm basically a scholar of the Middle East, although recently I have a new book out on egg freezing in the United States, which we can talk about. But yeah, so I worked in the Middle East for a very long time. And early on, I was focusing on female infertility, but really realized that a lot of the, infertility really wasn't a problem facing the woman in a couple. It was really due to the husband's infertility problems. And so I, began to study it, and I actually have a book about male infertility in the Middle East. I think that there are some genetic issues in the region. There are high rates of what we call consanguineous marriage, where people tend to marry within the larger family, second cousins, first cousins. And so there probably are some genetic issues at play, but also there's a lot of heavy male smoking in the Middle East. And in the big cities, there's probably a lot of environmental pollution. And we know that things like heavy metals are toxic to male sperm. And so this issue of declining sperm counts, I mean, it's been reported in the media sort of globally, and it's inconclusive. Male sperm around the world, is it getting worse over time? There's some debate about that, but certainly, male infertility is a really important reproductive health issue that just doesn't get much attention. And frankly, most men have no idea if they're fertile or infertile until they get married and start having problems conceiving with their partners. And then they go for semen analysis, and this is where they discover whether they have a poor sperm count or a low motility, the sperm don't move well. Some men have no sperm in their ejaculate. It's called azoospermia. And so there are a variety of different male infertility problems. And again, it just isn't something that people talk about. In the Middle East, though, I think one of the most interesting stories is that when this new reproductive technology called ICSI arrived in the region in the mid-1990s, men started hearing about it, and they sort of started coming out with their male infertility struggles, going to IVF clinics to, seek this ICSI solution. And so there was a real change, a real recognition that no, infertility isn't just a woman's reproductive health problem. Men can be infertile too. They need to take the burden off the shoulders of their female partners and sort of acknowledge and accept that they're infertile. And that really happened. And in fact, infertility, unfortunately, is often associated with manhood or womanhood. It's something wrong with the man. He's not a man. But with, the recognition that infertility is a medical condition that can be overcome in many cases, this medicalization sort of helped to lessen the stigma of infertility, including male infertility. And that's been a really good development in the Middle Eastern region. The Middle East also, although in the West we hear nothing good about the Middle East, the Middle East has a remarkable assisted reproductive technology sector. There are many IVF clinics throughout the region. It's actually one of the regions of the world that has done a lot, to sort of make treatment for infertility accessible. So it's a very interesting region, globally. And I would say that gender relations around infertility have improved dramatically over the years that I've been working there.
Now, in the past, do you think infertility was properly diagnosed, considering we didn't have the medical technology we have today?
Yeah, we have now, the semen analysis, for example, has been around for a very long time. To diagnose female infertility, you need to have sophisticated hormonal testing. Sometimes you need to do procedures to look at the sort of condition of the fallopian tubes. So these technologies for diagnosis have been around for a while. The problem here is just accessing. Can people access a place where they can get effective infertility diagnosis and treatment? And that is a global issue. It's estimated that only about half the infertile couples in the world, and this includes infertile couples in Western nations. Only about half of them ever get to a place where they could be diagnosed for their infertility problems. And then beyond that, the ones who get to the actual treatment, it's even a smaller percentage of infertile couples. And so what is the problem? The problem is the cost. Doing infertility diagnosis and treatment is costly. It's not covered in most parts of the world. I mean, infertility and its treatment is really something that we find in the private medical sector. And so there are huge issues of accessing effective diagnosis and treatment, especially IVF and all of the variants of IVF, including ICSI for male infertility. It's very costly. Just to give you an example, the U.S. is the most costly place in the world to do one cycle of in vitro fertilization. It costs at least $12,000 to get one cycle of IVF in the U.S. And often people, to be successful, have to do several cycles of IVF in order to have a baby. And so the U.S. is just sort of too expensive for many American couples. It's, you know, three times, it's about, the average around the world is much less. So it costs about $3,000 to $4,000 to do an IVF cycle sort of globally. But still, for many infertile couples, that's a huge amount of money. They can't afford it. And so the issue globally is just inability to access safe, effective, legal, and affordable infertility diagnosis and treatment services. And I care a lot about that. There's been a movement which was called the low-cost IVF movement to try to make IVF just more affordable for people. That movement has been going on for a while, but I can't say that it's really solved the issue of inaccessibility. There's a long, long way to go.
So what about this effect of age on childbearing? Could one of the main solutions simply be emphasizing having families at a younger age, as humanity has done throughout history?
I'm so glad that you brought up this issue, because it's one that in my recent research I've been thinking about a great deal. Yeah, first of all, around the world, global marriage rates are declining dramatically, so people are getting married less than they used to, and the age of childbearing has increased dramatically. So women are having children at later and later ages. You know, in Western countries, it's close to the age of 30 for first birth for women. But what I've discovered through a large study I did in the United States of women who had frozen their eggs is that, you know, women in this country and in many other countries around the world are facing difficulty in sort of creating a family because they can't find a partner. They're sort of doing their education. They're starting their careers. They get to the age of 30 or beyond. They haven't found the partner, which is an issue I'd like to talk about. But they also are not aware that fertility begins to decline slightly around the age of 32, but that there's a dramatic decline of a woman's fertility around the age of 37, which has been called the fertility cliff. And I learned in my own country that most women really had no idea about when age starts to affect their fertility. There really hadn't been any education about it in school. Often they hadn't talked to their gynecologists, that the gynecologists had never raised the issue about, you know, age and fertility. And so age is important to women's fertility. By the time a woman reaches the age of 40, the chances of conception are very, very low. But if women don't understand that, they don't really understand what we would call age-related fertility decline, they might be waiting and waiting, often waiting for a partner to emerge, and in effect, sort of losing their fertility, their chances for having a child because of age. And I think in the West, if you look at IVF clinic populations in Western countries, a lot of the reason people are there is because of age-related infertility. Women who are in their late 30s and early 40s who got there, you know, they maybe found their partner in their late 30s, but really didn't realize that the impact of age on their fertility. And sadly, you know, in the United States, in many schools, there's sort of early sex education, but it's all about how to prevent fertility, prevent childbearing. The discussion of if you wanted to have a child, you know, what is the fertile period? You know, how long are you fertile? That's really not part of education in America, at least. And so we need to do some education around age and fertility. And I think another deleterious thing that's happened is that the media, there's so much media coverage of celebrities, celebrity women who seem to be having children at age 48, age 50, and beyond, but without really revealing that they've probably used donor eggs, you know, not their own eggs, because it's very difficult to conceive at those late ages using one's own eggs. And so, you know, the sort of celebrity, older mother celebrity culture really hasn't helped, you know, in terms of making women realize that there's an endpoint to fertility for women. So yeah, it's a really important issue. I'm glad you brought it up.
Thank you, Professor Marcia Inhorn. Now after the break, we are going to continue our discussion and look at the options now available to address the growing infertility crisis.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Liberal democracy is failing in Africa, and Africa is failing under liberal democracy. But I also say that democracy is not a one-size-fits-all. That means if you are practicing a democratic system of government, you should make sure it conforms with your social structural dynamics, it conforms with your social political dynamics.
Welcome back. We are going to continue our discussion about global infertility with Marcia Inhorn. Now, she is a professor of anthropology and international affairs at Yale University and author of the book Motherhood on Ice. Thank you for joining us again, Marcia. I want to continue with something you said in the previous segment. What about surrogacy? What impact do you feel like that is having on infertility? And is it being more used for superficial reasons or for science?
Yeah, you know, the two sort of solutions that have come about for women who really are having, you know, profound difficulty in conceiving. One solution is egg donation, donor eggs. If your own eggs are too old or there's a problem with, you know, conceiving using your own eggs, there is now a huge industry globally, really, of donor egg. Okay. And so that's sort of one issue that has definitely, you know, come to the fore, that, you know, many women are using donor eggs. And sometimes, as we say, celebrities are not talking about that. But then there's surrogacy, or, you know, basically employing the womb, if you will, of another woman in order to bear the child. It often today is not using that person's eggs. It's, you know, conceiving an embryo with one's own eggs and sperm of one's partner, but having the pregnancy, you know, gestated in the womb of a surrogate. And, you know, surrogacy is important for some women who have absolute medical conditions whereby they cannot carry a pregnancy. And that's really how it started. And I guess that's what it was intended for, right? For women who, for one reason or another, they would not be able to carry a pregnancy to term. And so it has an important role, I think, in those kinds of cases. But surrogacy has certainly expanded in terms of who's using it. And I would say a huge use now is among gay male couples who want to have a biogenetically related child using their own sperm and then using donor egg and having the child gestated in the womb of a surrogate. So surrogacy services have definitely grown in the LGBTQ community for gay men. And, you know, you're talking about the sort of celebrity use of surrogates. Yeah, I mean, people who have a lot of money, it's extremely expensive to carry out a surrogacy. I mean, in, I think, the state of Connecticut, you're going to pay more than $100,000 to, you know, employ a surrogate and have everything carried out. It's expensive. It's not available in a lot of places. So it isn't a first choice. I mean, it is, like you said, sort of a last option for people who are facing infertility problems. I have not studied surrogacy. In the Middle East, where I've done most of my research, surrogacy is not allowed and it's not available. But it's certainly in Western countries, there's a growing market. And actually in other parts of the globe, there's a sort of global transnational movement of people to other countries to employ surrogates, usually because it's much less expensive to do so. So yeah, surrogacy is an interesting reproductive choice, a solution for some who cannot carry, gestate and carry a pregnancy to term.
In your research, have you found if climate change has had any effect on infertility?
Yeah, climate change. I mean, as I mentioned, there's been a huge debate about whether globally, sperm counts are decreasing. And so, you know, there is some evidence that really environmental issues do have an impact on male fertility, especially when there are toxins in an environment. We know that this isn't good for male fertility. I mean, heat, we know that heat, especially when men are in, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the kind of underwear men wear or, you know, hot tubs. You know, heat probably isn't good for male fertility. And so given that there's been a lot of discussion and actually, you know, increasing global temperatures, ultimately it might have some impact on male fertility over time. You know, in the United States right now, we're in the middle of this heat bomb. I mean, record high temperatures. And so in the future, there may be some impact. I mean, I'm not a climate or an environmental expert, but it is something to think about and something to be concerned about.
Are countries' governments taking infertility seriously, or should they be doing more about the crisis? You know, are there countries you consider to be handling the issue of infertility correctly?
Yeah, I mean, governments can really help their citizens who are infertile. And how can they do that? There need to be assisted reproductive technology services available because, frankly, a lot of infertility can only be overcome through the use of what we call ARTs, including IVF, ICSI for male infertility, intrauterine insemination. You know, these are called assisted reproductive technologies, and they're expensive, and that's why a lot of people cannot access them. But there are governments, especially in Western Europe, that consider infertility to be a very legitimate medical problem, something that the government should help people with. And so as part of their healthcare systems, especially societies that have what we call universal healthcare systems, they're including, you know, infertility diagnosis and treatment as part of the sort of healthcare package available to couples. And so that would be, for example, in the United Kingdom or in Australia or in Denmark. Many Western European countries have included some kind of infertility coverage as part of their sort of national healthcare systems. But sadly, that is not true in most other places around the world. In most other places, infertility diagnosis and treatment is not covered by the nation. It is not subsidized through healthcare insurance. And so people have to pay for it on their own. And it's extraordinarily expensive, as we've discussed. And so many countries could be doing a lot more to help infertile citizens in their midst. I will say there are some remarkable examples of countries, for example, in the Middle East that have decided to make infertility services available. I think an exceptional story is Turkey. Turkey decided that it should subsidize 2 cycles of IVF for every Turkish citizen who needed it. And what it did is it just brought infertile couples, especially from rural areas, you know, sort of into the IVF world in Turkey. The number of clinics increased sort of exponentially. And there was a huge uptake of IVF in that country, a huge improvement in access to treatment services. So even countries that aren't known as sort of wealthy Western countries could be doing a lot more to help their citizens overcome their infertility problems. So yeah, I do believe that, you know, the world could be doing a lot more, including the sort of international reproductive health world. Infertility hasn't been taken up as something that's important in reproductive health. The WHO has always sort of been interested in and cared about infertility, but a lot of the major, you know, reproductive health and global health organizations haven't really put any effort into the global infertility problem. And again, just to reiterate, about 10% of couples in any population are going to be infertile. And there's some parts of the world where that percentage is much higher, where 30% of couples in a society are going to be facing infertility problems. It's not an insignificant problem. And so there should be a lot more attention given to it. And unfortunately, there is not. So yes, we could be doing a lot more for infertile couples around the world to help them overcome their problem.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Marcia Inhorn. Now, science might never be able to cure every reason which causes infertility. But as we make progress to develop various solutions, it seems like society continues to develop factors which hurt chances for reproduction. Whether it be environmental or cultural, what we deem as progress might just be the path to mankind's own reduction. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.